Lincoln, Disc 22.
The indecisive Battle of Perryville, Kentucky, October 8, 1862, temporarily saved Buell from removal. But the officer corps of the Army of the Potomac was another matter. The principal generals and most of the headquarters staff were Democrats, and many felt no special loyalty to a Republican president who seemed bent on changing the nature and scope of the war. These high-ranking officers had developed an intense loyalty to their commander, and they generally shared McClellan's view that warfare was for professionals, and that civilian property, including slaves, shouldn't be touched by the armies. Most of them attributed McClellan's failure on the peninsula to ill-advised and politically motivated meddling by civilian authorities. Pope's humiliating defeat at the Second Battle of Bull Run and Lincoln's vacillation over restoring McClellan to command strengthened their contempt for the president. Just before the Battle of Antietam, members of McClellan's staff were reported to have seriously discussed a plan to counter-march to Washington and intimidate the president, so that he would abandon his attempt to interfere with slavery and the war could be ended. The president's Emancipation Proclamation, reported General Fitzjohn Porter, was ridiculed in the army, causing disgust, discontent, and expressions of disloyalty to the views of the administration, amounting to insubordination. Among the Potomac Army clique, General Pope reported there was open talk of Lincoln's weakness and the necessity of replacing him by some stronger man. After the Battle of Antietam, Lincoln moved with great delicacy to determine whether McClellan was involved in these schemes. The general, for his part, was equally curious whether he still held the president's confidence. Because Lincoln sent him only meager congratulations after the Battle of Antietam, which McClellan considered a masterpiece of military art, the general feared the president had fallen under the sway of his opponents. Consequently, he sent Alan Pinkerton, his chief of intelligence, who was presumably an expert in ferreting out information, to the White House. In Pinkerton's long interview with the president on September 22nd, the day the Emancipation Proclamation was issued, though that document was never mentioned, McClellan was using his chief detective to spy on the president, and the president was using the detective to spy on his commanding general. From Pinkerton, Lincoln learned a great deal more than the detective thought he was revealing. Employing the techniques for cross-examining a witness he had perfected during his years at the bar, he expressed himself, so Pinkerton wrote McClellan, as humbly desirous of knowing some things which he supposed from the pressure on your mind you hadn't advised him on, or that you considered was of minor importance, not sufficiently worthy of notice for you to send to him. Then, using language so deferential that Pinkerton didn't realize he was being grilled, the president asked a series of telling questions. Why had McClellan failed to come to the rescue of the Union garrison at Harper's Ferry, which had been forced to surrender to Stonewall Jackson just before Antietam? What was the relative strength of the Union and Confederate forces at Antietam? He appeared to accept McClellan's and Pinkerton's preposterous estimate that the Confederates had 140,000 men, when in fact Lee's effective troops numbered about 52,000. Why did the Union Army not renew the attack the day after the battle? How were the Confederates able to slip back unhindered across the Potomac River? Lincoln impressed the detective as entirely friendly toward McClellan. He wasn't at all suspicious when the president used uncharacteristically effusive language to express the nation's deep debt of gratitude to McClellan for his great and decisive victories at South Mountain and Antietam. Lincoln told him he had no doubt that McClellan had fought the Battle of Antietam skillfully, much more so than any general he knew of could have done, and said that he was highly pleased and gratified with all you had done. "I'm rather prejudiced against him," Pinkerton concluded his report, "but I must confess that he impresses me more at this interview with his honesty towards you and his desire to do you justice than he's ever done before." The information Lincoln wormed out of Pinkerton convinced the president that Antietam had not been a great victory, but a lost opportunity, squandered by the high command of the Army of the Potomac. While he didn't get any evidence from Pinkerton that McClellan was disloyal, his suspicions grew as the detective ingenuously poured out a story of wasted chances. He came to suspect that the leaders of the Army of the Potomac had only a half-hearted commitment to crushing the Confederacy. There was little reliable evidence to justify this belief, but in these days, after the Battle of Antietam and the issuing of the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln was in a highly anxious state, and he magnified barroom boasting and military gossip about the need for a dictator into a real threat. He resolved to end it. Just a few days after his interview with Pinkerton, the president learned that Major John J. Key of Halleck's staff had been reported as saying that the Union Army hadn't bagged the Confederates after Antietam because that's not the game. "The object is that neither army shall get much advantage of the other," Key went on, "that both shall be kept in the field till they're exhausted, when we'll make a compromise and save slavery." Summoning Key to the White House on September 27th, the president held an impromptu court-martial, heard the evidence against the major, ruled that it was wholly inadmissible for any gentleman holding a military commission from the United States to utter such sentiments, and ordered him dismissed forthwith from the army. If there ever had been a game among Union men not to take advantage of victories over the Confederates, the president stated grimly, it was his object to break up that game. Lincoln terminated Key's promising military career with reluctance, but he thought it necessary to give an example and a warning to a class of officers in the army not very inconsiderable in numbers. He feared Key's silly, treasonable remarks were staff talk, and I wanted an example. In all probability, he knew that John J. Key's brother was Thomas M. Key, acting judge advocate on McClellan's staff, and one of the general's most trusted political advisors. Lincoln's suspicion that McClellan was disloyal had no basis, but he was correct in thinking that the general didn't approve of his policies. McClellan was opposed to both the Emancipation Proclamation, which he privately labeled infamous, and the suspension of habeas corpus. He asked William H. Aspinwall, a political advisor in New York, what he ought to say about these measures, which meant inaugurating servile war, emancipating the slaves, and at one stroke of the pen changing our free institutions into a despotism. Aspinwall replied that the general was under no obligation to make any public statement, since he was under oath to obey his commander-in-chief. When the Blair family reminded him of what had happened to John Key, McClellan gave up any plan of public opposition to the proclamations. Determined to test the stories about disloyalty in McClellan's entourage, the president, with almost no notice, slipped out of Washington on October 1st to visit the sites of the recent battles and to inspect the army. He was late in arriving at the headquarters of McClellan's army, and some soldiers were disappointed to see the President of the United States driving up in a common ambulance, with his long legs doubled up so that his knees almost struck his chin, and grinning out of the windows like a baboon. "Mr. Lincoln," concluded one, "not only is the ugliest man I ever saw, but the most uncouth and gawky in his manners and appearance." Taking the president out to the Antietam battlefield, McClellan tried to explain what had taken place on September 17th. But Lincoln turned away abruptly and returned to camp. He spent the night in a tent adjacent to McClellan's. At daybreak the next day, the president woke up O.M. Hatch, a Springfield neighbor who accompanied him on his trip, and walked with him to a high point from which almost the entire army camp could be seen. Leaning toward his friend, Lincoln almost whispered, "Hatch, Hatch, what is all this?" "Why, Mr. Lincoln," replied Hatch, "this is the Army of the Potomac." After a moment's pause, the president straightened up and said in a louder voice, "No, Hatch, no. This is General McClellan's bodyguard." Later, Lincoln, mounted on a spirited coal-black horse, reviewed the troops. But they received from him none of the cordial greetings and salutes to which they were accustomed. Instead, he rode the lines at a quick trot, apparently taking little notice of the men and offering, one disgruntled officer related, not a word of approval, not even a smile of approbation. After the review of Burnside's corps, ambulances took him and his party the 2 or 3 miles to Fitz John Porter's corps. And along the way, he asked Ward Hill Lehman to sing his favorite little sad song, a ballad called 20 Years Ago. Afterward, to break the gloomy mood, Lehman also sang 2 or 3 little comic things, including a piece called Picayune Butler. The episode was one Lincoln came to regret, for opponents later charged that he'd desecrated the battlefield by singing ribald songs over the graves of the Union dead. During the visit, Lincoln managed to conceal his negative view of McClellan, and the general hid his low opinion of the president. McClellan reported to his wife that the president was very kind personally and very affable, and that he said he was convinced I was the best general in the country. Shortly afterward, McClellan attempted to reciprocate the compliment by issuing a general order to his troops announcing, for the first time, that the president had issued an emancipation proclamation and that it was the duty of good soldiers to obey their country's laws. He took care to see that a copy of this document reached the president himself. Lincoln returned to Washington generally pleased with his visit. "I'm now stronger with the Army of the Potomac than McClellan," he told a friend. The troops that had been most resentful when he named Pope to command, recognized that he'd tried to rectify his mistake by restoring McClellan to command. During the recent campaign, they saw that the president and the War Department gave McClellan everything that he asked for. But he'd thrown away his chance to win a decisive battle and had lost the opportunity to push Lee's army into the Potomac. "The supremacy of the civil power has been restored," he rejoiced, "and the executive is again master of the situation." Now confident that he could remove McClellan without causing a mutiny, the president nevertheless delayed. While at Antietam, he'd warned the general against over-cautiousness. and he thought he had McClellan's promise to pursue Lee's army into Virginia. He wanted to give the general one more chance. Lincoln, as Nicolay noted scornfully, habitually indulged McClellan in his whims and complaints and shortcomings as a mother would indulge her baby. But McClellan began giving arguments why he could not advance. He exhausted the president's patience with plaintive reports that his troops were worn out and his supplies depleted. Exasperated, Lincoln noted that McClellan delayed for 19 days before putting a man across the Potomac, and that it took 9 more days to bring the whole army across. While his huge army lay quietly north of the Potomac, Jeb Stuart led a daring Confederate cavalry raid into Maryland and Pennsylvania, where he destroyed military stores, machine shops, and trains at Chambersburg, and returned almost unscathed. The raid had no special military importance, but because it occurred just a few days before the elections, it was especially vexatious and embarrassing. Lincoln, as Nicolay reported, well nigh lost his temper over it, but once again, he restrained himself. In the months after Antietam and Perryville, the president exhibited a growing mastery of military affairs. Getting little help from Halleck, who responded to inquiries by scratching his elbows and taking all sides of every question, Lincoln had to apply his good common sense to the problems of the army. On his trip to Antietam, he'd been impressed by the number of stragglers from the Union Army, and he began making notes on the enormous number of soldiers who were absent from their regiments. Some were deserters, but more had furloughs. "You won't find a city, a town, or a village where soldiers and officers on furlough aren't plenty as blackberries," he complained to some visitors in early November. "To fill up the army is like undertaking to shovel fleas. You take up a shovelful," and he made a comical gesture, "but before you can dump them anywhere, they're gone." The root of this problem, he began to realize, was that neither the generals nor the people had recognized that they were at war, and that it would take hard, tough fighting to win it. "They've got the idea into their heads that we're going to get out of this fix somehow by strategy," he exclaimed. "That's the word, strategy. General McClellan thinks he's going to whip the rebels by strategy, and the army's got the same notion." It was to this belief in strategy that he attributed both Buell's leisurely pursuit of Bragg into Tennessee after the Battle of Perryville, and McClellan's slowness to move against Lee after Antietam. Leaving Halleck to urge Buell on, Lincoln devoted himself to getting McClellan to move, and he began sending the general pointed, short messages that amounted, as Nicolay said, to poking sharp sticks under Little Mac's ribs. Resenting the mean and dirty character of the dispatches he received from Washington, McClellan told his wife, "There never was a truer epithet applied to a certain individual than that of the gorilla." The breaking point came in late October. Facing a bitterly contested election, the Republican governors and representatives from Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois demanded that Lincoln remove Buell, whose Army of the Ohio was largely recruited from those states. When that general, oblivious to political reality and apparently indifferent to the wishes of his military superiors in Washington, announced that he was not going into eastern Tennessee, where Unionists were clamoring for protection, but was going to make his winter quarters in the comfortable city of Nashville, even the president could no longer defend him. On October 24th, Buell was relieved, and a few days later, Rosecrans took command of his troops, reorganized as the Army of the Cumberland. At almost the same time, McClellan informed the president that the Army of the Potomac could not pursue Lee because his cavalry horses were absolutely broken down from fatigue and want of flesh. Lincoln's temper snapped. "Will you pardon me for asking what the horses of your army have done since the Battle of Antietam that fatigue anything?" he shot back. In a subsequent message, he attempted to tone down his language and said he certainly intended no injustice. But the fate of McClellan had been decided. He told Francis P. Blair, Sr., that he'd tried long enough to bore with an auger too dull to take hold. Telling Secretary Chase that it was inexpedient to remove the general before the elections, the president bided his time. But on November 5th, he directed Halleck to relieve McClellan and entrusted the command of the Army of the Potomac to Ambrose E. Burnside. Naming Rosecrans and Burnside was a shrewd move. Burnside, in particular, was a happy choice. In addition to having some military reputation from his expedition against Roanoke Island, he looked like a great commander. His sturdy figure, his commanding presence, and even his elaborate side whiskers gave an impression of manly competence. Generally considered a protege of McClellan, he would be less objectionable to that general's admirers than almost any other possible commander. Yet McClellan's enemies were aware that their friendship had recently cooled, since McClellan spoke slightingly of Burnside's slowness to advance at Antietam. Known to be generally in favor of the president's policies, Rosecrans and Burnside were politically neutral. Unlike McClellan, they were not Democratic partisans, nor were they aligned with either the moderate or the radical faction of the Republican Party. In the past, Republican moderates had supported commanders like McClellan and Buell, practitioners of limited war waged by professionals with minimal impact on civilians. The radicals, and more particularly the vocal ultra-radical Jacobins, looked to military leaders like Joseph Hooker, who promised to bring the war to the people of the Confederacy and to revolutionize Southern society. Belonging to neither group, Lincoln tried to stake out the central ground for his own. Whether the appointments of Burnside and Rosecrans were a shrewd military move was open to question. Burnside himself said that he wasn't capable of leading the Army of the Potomac, and Rosecrans had hitherto displayed no talent for a large command. But for the moment, most were willing to give the new commanders a fair trial, and the president gained a little time to attend to some of the numerous other duties of his office, necessarily neglected during the previous months of crisis. He continued to work long hours, rising early, often after a sleepless night, to go to his White House office before his breakfast, which consisted of a cup of coffee and an egg. Returning to his desk after breakfast, he examined papers and signed commissions for another hour or so. There were always routine matters to be handled, like the required congratulations to Frederick, Grand Duke of Baden, on the announcement of the marriage of Her Grand Ducal Highness, the Princess Leopoldina of Baden, to His Most Serene Highness, the Prince Hermann of Hohenlohe-Langenburg. Of course, the State Department drafted these messages, but the president had to sign them. In the course of a morning, he efficiently handled many requests by briefly endorsing the papers submitted to General Halleck, asking as favorable consideration as may be consistent, or to Secretary Caleb B. Smith, "Let the appointment be made as within recommended," or Secretary of War, "Please make such response to this as may seem proper." At 10 o'clock, his office hours for petitioners and visitors began. A visitor, C. Van Santford, made notes on those who called on the president in a single morning. One dapper, smooth-faced, boyish-looking little person whispered a request apparently for a clerkship, until the president dismissed him with an emphatic, "Yes, yes, I know all about it, and will give it proper attention." A lieutenant asked to be appointed to head a colored regiment, though the decision to employ blacks in the army hadn't yet been made. But Lincoln saw that he really was only asking to be promoted to colonel, and cut him off. Then a sturdy, honest-looking German soldier, who'd lost a leg and hobbled in on crutches, asked the president for a job in Washington, but he had no papers or credentials to show how he'd lost his leg. "How am I to know that you lost it in battle or didn't lose it by a trap after getting into somebody's orchard?" Lincoln asked with a droll smile. Then, relenting, he gave the young man a card to present to a local quartermaster. The next visitor got a less kindly reception. Apparently, he wanted to use the president's name in connection with a business project, pleading that he was too old and obscure to start up on his own. "No," exclaimed Lincoln indignantly. "Do you take the president of the United States to be a commission broker? You've come to the wrong place. And for you and everyone who comes for such purposes, there's the door." After that, a white-haired, gentlemanly-looking person and his very pretty and prepossessing daughter asked simply to pay their respects, and the president greeted them cordially in his frank, bland, and familiar manner. Next, a Scottish visitor reported that his countrymen hoped the president would stand firmly behind his Emancipation Proclamation, and Lincoln pledged, "God helping me, I trust to prove true to a principle which I feel to be right." His final caller of the morning, a rough Western countryman, had come by to see the president and have the honor of shaking hands with him. Eyeing his tall visitor, Lincoln engaged in a little exercise that he always found amusing, and challenged the man to compare heights with him. When the countryman proved to be a shade taller than 6'4", Lincoln congratulated him and couldn't resist the inevitable pun, "You actually stand higher today than your president." On the day when Van Santford was an observer, the president ended his open office hours at noon. But on most days, after a brief lunch, when he remembered to eat anything, he continued to receive petitioners in the afternoons. Though his secretaries fretted that he was wasting his time in these interviews, Lincoln felt that he gained much from what he called his public opinion baths. These visits, random, sporadic, and inconsequential as they often proved to be, offered the president an opportunity, in these days before scientific public opinion polling, to get some idea of how ordinary people felt about him and his administration. Customarily, the president's open office hours were suspended on 2 afternoons each week for cabinet meetings. Occasionally, when he could spare the time, he went for a horseback ride in the afternoon. And from time to time, Mrs. Lincoln, concerned about her husband's health, insisted that he come on a carriage ride with her, usually to visit the army camps around Washington or the soldiers' hospitals. Then, after dinner, when Lincoln absently ate whatever was put in front of him and drank no wine, he frequently returned to his White House office, sometimes working 3 or 4 more hours. When important military movements were underway, he would often wrap his long gray shawl about his shoulders and walk over to the telegraphic office in the War Department, usually without escort or guard. There he'd read the latest dispatches from the armies and talk and banter with the telegraph operators. Often it was near midnight before he got back to the living quarters of the White House. "I consider myself fortunate," Mary Lincoln lamented, "if at 11 o'clock I once more find myself in the pleasant room, and very especially if my tired and weary husband is there resting in the lounge to receive me, to chat over the occurrences of the day." Even in the brief honeymoon period after Burnside and Rosecrans assumed command of their armies, there were few uneventful days like the one chronicled by Van Sant Voort. Serious problems arose that only a president could decide. During October and November, much of Lincoln's attention had to be given to an uprising among the Sioux Indians of Minnesota. Bureaucratic delays in paying these Indians the annuities promised to them at the time they gave up most of their land left the Sioux desperate and almost starving. During the summer, their agent unsuccessfully tried to get food for them, but his supplier announced, "So far as I'm concerned, if they're hungry, let them eat grass or their own dung." In August, some young Sioux men, raiding an Acton, Minnesota farm for eggs, broke into the house and killed 5 white settlers. Quickly, violence spread throughout southwestern Minnesota, and before the Indian uprising could be quelled, more than 350 whites had been killed. It was the largest massacre of whites by Indians in American history. When news of the uprising reached Washington, Lincoln was almost wholly absorbed by Lee's invasion of Maryland, and he could devote little attention to Indian affairs. He did dispatch General Pope, fresh from his defeat at Second Bull Run, to take charge of military operations against the Sioux. The general accepted the assignment reluctantly. He felt that the president had been feeble, cowardly, and shameful in failing to defend him from his critics. Once in Minnesota, Pope deflected his hostility from the president to the rebellious Indians. Finding panic everywhere in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and predicting a general Indian war all along the frontier unless immediate steps are taken to put a stop to it, he announced, "It's my purpose utterly to exterminate the Sioux if I have the power to do so. They're to be treated as maniacs or wild beasts." With the enthusiastic cooperation of Minnesota authorities, who saw an opportunity to gain revenge and to secure additional Indian lands, Union troops by early October broke the back of the rebellion, and a military commission began to try more than 1,500 Indians, including women and children, who had been captured. As soon as the news reached Washington in mid-October, the president told Pope to stage no executions without his sanction. To gain further information and to help restore peace, he sent Assistant Secretary of the Interior John P. Usher, soon to replace Caleb B. Smith in the cabinet, to Minnesota, and he also sought the advice of Episcopal Bishop Henry B. Whipple, who advised A new policy of honesty was needed for dealing with this wronged and neglected race. Lincoln admitted that he was poorly informed on Indian affairs. In September, when Chief John Ross had urged him to offer military protection to the Cherokees, who had fallen under Confederate control, the president told him, "In the multitude of cares claiming my constant attention, I have been unable to examine and determine the exact treaty relations between the United States and the Cherokee Nation." He had little acquaintance with Indians. In general, like most whites of his generation, he considered the Indians a barbarous people who were a barrier to progress. The ceremonial visits of Indian chiefs, dressed in their tribal regalia, he welcomed, both because they were exotic and because he rather enjoyed playing the role of their great father, addressing them in pidgin English and explaining that this world is a great round ball. Occasionally, as during the following year, he would offer them little homilies on how they could profit by learning the arts of civilization, pointing out the great difference between this pale-faced people and their red brethren. He told a group in the White House that whites had become numerous and prosperous partly because they were farmers rather than hunters. Even though he admitted that we're now engaged in a great war between one another, he also offered another reason for white success. We're not, as a race, so much disposed to fight and kill one another as our red brethren. The irony was unintentional. Nor did Lincoln know much about the operations of the Office of Indian Affairs in the Department of the Interior. When he'd appointed Caleb B. Smith as Secretary of the Interior and William P. Dole as Indian Commissioner, he was rewarding them for political favors, not for interest in or concern for the Indians. In naming their subordinates, the president almost invariably followed the wishes of the Republican members of Congress. A typical note directed Smith, "Please make out and send blank appointments for all Indian places to serve in Wisconsin in favor of the persons unitedly recommended by the Wisconsin congressional delegation." It was assumed that Indian agents and Indian traders would make profits from their positions, not merely for themselves, but for their Republican sponsors. But what was now going on in Minnesota far exceeded the usual fraud and embezzlement connected with the Indian service. Whites, who'd been terrified during the uprising, were determined to secure vengeance. Republican Governor Alexander Ramsey, calling the Sioux assassins and ravishers of wives and sisters and daughters, insisted that whites in his state will not tolerate their presence in any number or in any condition. Many thought the defeat of the Sioux offered an opportunity to drive not merely that tribe, but the peaceable Chippewas out of the state and to confiscate their lands. On November 8th, Lincoln received from Minnesota a list of 303 Sioux men the military commission had condemned to die. Promptly, the president directed General Pope to send complete records of these convictions, indicating the more guilty and influential of the culprits. Pope responded that the people of Minnesota were so exasperated that if everyone on the list wasn't executed, it would be nearly impossible to prevent the indiscriminate massacre of all the Indians, old men, women, and children. Minnesota Senator Morton S. Wilkinson echoed the threat. "Either the Indians must be punished according to law, or they'll be murdered without law." Governor Ramsey added that unless every condemned Sioux Indian was executed, private revenge would, on all this border, take the place of official judgment on these Indians. But the president, greatly influenced by Bishop Whipple and Commissioner Dole, refused to be stampeded. He consulted Judge Advocate General Joseph Holt about a way of avoiding a decision by allowing state authorities to determine which Indians should die. When Holt told him firmly, "The power cannot be delegated," the president deliberately went through the record of each convicted man, seeking to identify those who'd been guilty of the most atrocious crimes, especially murder of innocent farmers and rape. He came up with a list of 39 names, which he carefully wrote out in his own hand. Tehedonecha, Tazu, Alias, Planduta, and so on. Wiring the list to the military authorities, he warned the telegraph operator to be particularly careful, since even a slight error might send the wrong man to his death. On December 26th, the 38 men, one more man was pardoned at the last minute, were executed. The largest public execution in American history. Few praised Lincoln for reducing the list of condemned men. On the contrary, his clemency lighted a brief firestorm of protest in Minnesota, which didn't die down until the Secretary of the Interior promised the white settlers reasonable compensation for the depredations committed. Even so, considerable resentment remained against Lincoln and his administration, so that in 1864, Republicans lost strength in Minnesota. Senator, formerly Governor, Ramsey, told the president that if he'd hanged more Indians, he would have had a larger majority. "I couldn't afford to hang men for votes," Lincoln replied. The Indian uprising in Minnesota was but one of the many subjects that the president had to address in his annual message to Congress on the State of the Union. Indeed, preparing that message, which was due on December 1st, took up so much of his time that he felt obliged to limit his public receptions to 2 hours each day during November. The message offered Lincoln an opportunity to reformulate the basic goals of his administration. He knew that it would be addressed to a highly critical audience. Congressional Democrats, cheered by the outcome of the recent elections, which would increase their membership in the next House of Representatives from 44 to 72, could be counted upon to be more partisan than usual, less inclined to follow the lead of a Republican president. Republicans in both houses would likely be more restive, too. Many of the more conservative Republican representatives, especially those from New York, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, were now lame ducks, and their influence was diminished. The radical members had a growing sense of desperation. Many feared that Lincoln, after studying the election returns, would fall under conservative influences. Signs of a retreat were discovered in his appointment of Burnside instead of a radical general like Joseph Hooker, and they worried that he might renege on his promise to issue a final emancipation decree on January 1st. Thaddeus Stevens thought it was urgent to commit the president to a radical program before the locos, that is, the Democrats, came in. All expected the message to define the president's position. Lincoln didn't deliver his message in person to the Congress. Instead, as was customary, his secretary, Nicolay, took the document to Capitol Hill, where a clerk read it aloud. Much of the message was entirely routine in nature, summarizing the work of the departments, usually in words supplied to the president by members of the cabinet. It began with a long account of foreign relations that concluded with a balanced sentence written by Seward: "If the condition of our relations with other nations is less gratifying than it has usually been at former periods, it is certainly more satisfactory that a nation so unhappily distracted as we are might reasonably have apprehended." The president then claimed the congressman's most diligent consideration of financial affairs, and, in passages supplied by Secretary Chase, called for a return to specie payments at the earliest period compatible with due regard to all interests concerned, and urged the creation of a national banking system. The message went on to discuss the condition of the Post Office Department, which reported much improved efficiency, of the Department of the Interior, including a summary of the Sioux uprising, and of the newly created Department of Agriculture, which was headed by a commissioner and was not represented in the cabinet. Lincoln then turned, rather surprisingly, to a restatement of the physical impossibility of separating the United States into two republics, and quoted a long extract from his inaugural address on this point. Rather puzzlingly, he next paid tribute to the Upper Mississippi and Ohio Valley region, which he said was the great body of the Republic. Having no sea coast, this region could never consent to a partition of the Union that would deprive it of either its eastern or its western outlets. As the clerk droned on, congressmen must have felt that they were listening to a fairly conventional, if not especially well-organized, presidential message. But it came alive when Lincoln reached the topic that really interested him: compensated emancipation. The subject came as a surprise to many who thought the Emancipation Proclamation had settled that question. But by referring to the Emancipation Proclamation only in passing, Lincoln was expressing his continuing doubts about the efficacy of his decree. In private conversations, even more than in his public message, he was pessimistic, predicting that the proclamation would not make a single Negro free beyond our military reach. About this time, he entertained a group of clergymen who visited the White House with an anecdote about a case in a Western court where a lawyer tried to establish that a calf had five legs by calling the tail a leg. "But," said the president, "the decision of the judge was that calling the tail a leg didn't make it a leg, and the calf had but four legs after all." So, he reminded his guests, proclaiming slaves free didn't make them free. The president was aware that neither the preliminary proclamation nor the final decree promised on January 1st affected slavery in the border states and in the states of the Upper South. Moreover, he recognized that the Emancipation Proclamation had a legal basis only as an act of war. Once peace came, the courts might declare it unconstitutional, or a new administration might retract it. Consequently, his State of the Union address suggested a way of permanently getting rid of slavery throughout the land. In an unusual attempt at executive leadership, the president proposed three amendments to the Constitution. The first authorized the payment of United States bonds to any state that abolished slavery by January 1, 1900. The second guaranteed the freedom of all slaves who enjoyed actual freedom by the chances of the war. but authorized payment to their masters if they were not disloyal. And the third authorized congressional appropriations for colonizing free colored persons with their own consent at any place or places without the United States. The package was new, but the proposals were similar to those the president had put forward in his March message to Congress, and the whole plan was much like the one he'd vainly entreated the border state congressman to accept in June. Most who were allowed to preview the president's message judged the plan impracticable. Though touched by the noble sentiments and admirable language of the message, Chase advised against including the specifics of the plan, since there's no probability that a vote of two-thirds can be commanded for any amendment of the Constitution touching slavery, or that any such amendment can obtain the sanction of two-thirds of the states. Browning judged that the president was suffering from a hallucination in proposing a scheme which, even if unopposed, would require at least 4 years to be adopted. Aware of the difficulties, Lincoln argued for his plan with a passion and eloquence not shown in his public addresses since the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Mr. Lincoln's whole soul is absorbed in his plan of remunerative emancipation, David Davis reported, and he thinks if Congress don't fail him, that the problem is solved. Feeding his uncharacteristic optimism were rumors that Maryland and Kentucky might now be ready to accept compensated emancipation. Moreover, the president thought there was a good possibility, though he was careful not to mention this to Congress, that some of the southern slave states, or parts of them, would be back in the Union before the end of the year. Throughout the fall, Lincoln had been actively encouraging both southern Unionists and Army officers stationed in the South to bring about what was, in effect, a secession from the Confederacy through the election of loyal representatives and senators who would ask for their rightful seats in the United States Congress. He had some hope that these elections would take place in the occupied areas of Tennessee, Arkansas, and the Norfolk region of Virginia, but he pinned his hopes on Louisiana, where, he hoped, gentlemen of character willing to swear support of the Constitution as of old and known to be above reasonable suspicion of duplicity would take the lead in restoring their state to the Union so as to have peace again upon the old terms under the Constitution of the United States. All see how such action will connect with and affect the proclamation of September 22nd, he added significantly. In other words, if the southern states, or parts of them, set up loyal governments and sent representatives to Congress, they'd be exempt from the final proclamation of emancipation. Elated that he might be able to bring some of the rebellious states back into the Union, and confident that if Burnside or Rosecrans or Grant could inflict a crippling blow on the enemy, others would follow, Lincoln foresaw the possibility that by January the war might be nearly over and the Union might be restored. But the United States would still be a slaveholding nation. This was not a prospect that troubled him for the long run, because he was convinced that slavery was doomed. He thinks the foundations of slavery have been cracked by the war, by the rebels, a visitor reported in November. Consequently, the main task now was to plan for a transition from slavery to freedom. Such a plan had to be acceptable to the whites of the border states, whose support Lincoln now needed even more because of Republican defeats in recent elections, and it had to be attractive to whites in the Deep South if their newly restored loyalty was to prove genuine. But what concerned him most, the interviewer recorded, was to provide for the blacks. He thinks still that many of them will colonize and that the South will be compelled to resort to the apprentice system. He was confident his plan would meet all these goals. But if the plan was to work, it would have to be adopted immediately. Time was short because he was firmly committed to issuing his final Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st. From the expiration of the days of grace, he told a visitor, the character of the war will be changed. It will be one of subjugation and extermination. The prospects for voluntary emancipation in the border states would be diminished. Loss, too, would be the president's most powerful hold on whites in the Confederacy. The possibility that they could retrieve something from their peculiar institution if they returned to the Union. Behind Lincoln's urgency was another, less clearly articulated purpose. There had been grave erosion of support in the coalition on which he depended. During the past 6 months, necessity and, as Lincoln thought, Providence had pushed his administration, though in uncertain spurts and starts, in a more radical direction. The Emancipation Proclamation and the removal of McClellan were the most obvious examples. These moves had cost him much of his support from moderates, yet did little to win the support of radical Republicans. If the president was to survive politically, he had to assert his leadership by moving back toward the center. That need gave to the State of the Union message what Lincoln himself admitted might seem a tone of undue earnestness. Ardently, he urged the Congress to unite behind his plan, which would restore the national authority and national prosperity and perpetuate both indefinitely. The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present, he reminded the legislators. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country. Fellow citizens, he began his concluding paragraph, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. We know how to save the Union. The world knows we do know how to save it. Now the time had come to act. And in phrases that had a Shakespearean cadence, the president reminded the legislators, in giving freedom to the slave, we assure freedom to the free, honorable alike in what we give and what we preserve. Now was the time for decision. We shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth. Any chance for Lincoln's plan for a speedy restoration of the Union was lost on December 13th. General Burnside, against the advice and warnings of the president, threw the Army of the Potomac across the Rappahannock into Fredericksburg. Then he ordered his soldiers to advance directly uphill toward Marye's Heights, where the Confederates lay waiting for them. By the end of the day, 1 in 10 of Burnside's soldiers was a casualty, dead, wounded, or missing. The Confederate losses were less than half as great. It was the worst defeat in the history of the American Army. News of Burnside's defeat was slow to reach the anxious president. Not until late at night did he learn of the outcome from Henry Villard. Lincoln grilled the journalist, who'd come straight from the battlefield, about the extent of Union losses, the morale of the troops, and the chances for success if another attack was made. Fearing that the president didn't fully understand the extent of the catastrophe, Villard stressed that every general officer he'd encountered thought that success was impossible, and that the army might suffer a worse disaster unless it was immediately withdrawn to the north side of the river. "I hope it's not so bad as all that," Lincoln said with a melancholy smile. It was. As the news of Fredericksburg trickled out, a wave of anger swept the North. Little of it was directed at Burnside, who frankly admitted his incompetence and expressed willingness to assume all the responsibility. Halleck was the object of much of the abuse, as was Stanton, for they were charged with failing to support the army. But most of the blame was heaped on the Lincoln administration, for the bloody defeat at Fredericksburg seemed only a part of a larger pattern of failure and incompetence. As Joseph Medill of the Chicago Tribune declared, "Failure of the army, weight of taxes, depreciation of money, want of cotton, increasing national debt, deaths in the army, no prospect of success, the continued closure of the Mississippi River, all combined to produce the existing state of despondency and desperation." Everybody, he concluded, felt that the war is drawing toward a disastrous and disgraceful termination. The notes of complaint and disillusionment with the Lincoln administration, clearly audible since the failure of the Peninsula campaign, now became deafening. A few critics blamed the president personally. One angry Wisconsin resident demanded that both Lincoln and the traitorous Mrs. Lincoln resign. And Senator Wilkinson of Minnesota, outraged at the leniency Lincoln showed toward the Sioux Indians, asserted there was no hope for the country except in the death of the president and a new administration. But most critics were willing to admit Lincoln's good intentions, even though they doubted his will. Recognizing that they couldn't replace a president who still had nearly half his term to serve, they looked for ways to give the administration backbone. Lincoln, said Senator Grimes, was only a toe-string of a president who had to be bound up with strong, sturdy rods in the shape of cabinet ministers. Discontent with the administration, then, centered on the cabinet. Throughout the last half of 1862, newspapers frequently carried stories of impending cabinet reorganization. Most of the reports stressed the want of harmony in the cabinet, and in many cases they were true. Except for Seward, nearly every cabinet member complained of Lincoln's lack of system in consulting his ministers. There were, in theory, 2 cabinet meetings a week. But in actuality, as Gideon Wells reported, these sessions were infrequent, irregular, and without system. Seward often failed to attend, though there was general reluctance to discuss major issues in the absence of the Secretary of State. He preferred, as Wells said censoriously, to spend a considerable portion of every day with the president, patronizing and instructing him, hearing and telling anecdotes, relating interesting details of occurrences in the Senate, and inculcating his political party notions. "When Stanton attended," said Wells, "it was only to whisper to the president or take the dispatches or the papers from his pocket and go into a corner with the president." The meetings were highly informal. Charles Sumner reported that at some of the cabinet sessions he was invited to attend, the president put his feet up on the table, his heels higher than his head, and the other members appropriated extra chairs to rest their legs on. Chase complained that the meetings followed no agenda and allowed no real exchange of views among the secretaries. Secretary of the Interior Smith added that, unlike other presidents, Lincoln decided the most important questions without consulting his cabinet, seeking their advice, as he did when he was about to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, as critics only. Members of the cabinet didn't get along with each other. Wells and Chase distrusted Seward because they suspected his bland amiability and his perpetual optimism, and believed that he failed to understand the seriousness of the nation's crisis. Stanton's irascible, secretive manner prevented other cabinet members from becoming his friends, though he generally managed to work amicably with Chase. Wells, wearing his massive wig, was something of a figure of fun to his colleagues. Even Lincoln made gentle jokes about Father Neptune, who was thought to be such an old fogey that he was examining a model of Noah's Ark with a view to its introduction into the United States Navy. Nearly everybody agreed that Smith was a cabinet member of no consequence, and, as David Davis reported, a man with neither heart nor sincerity about him. His resignation was eagerly awaited, and Montgomery Blair, the Postmaster General, was bitterly opposed to anyone who might stand in the way of his or his family's advancement. Chase and Stanton were the particular objects of his hatred. Lincoln wasn't only aware of this dissonance, he was prepared to tolerate, and perhaps even to encourage, creative friction among his advisers. He understood that the conflicts among his cabinet members weren't so fundamental as they seemed. The irritable clashes among the cabinet officers reflected differences in personality, not ideology. Unconsciously, they were rivals for the esteem and affection of the president. It was a problem that Lincoln, like other men of enormous personal magnetism, had to live with throughout his life. And he understood that the rivalry between Seward and Chase, or between Stanton and Wells, was much like that between Herndon and Mary Lincoln back in Springfield, or between Mrs. Lincoln and Nicolay and Hay during the White House years. During the months when the president seemed to be on a radical course, it was the conservative Republicans who demanded that he reorganize his cabinet. For instance, in early September, Samuel Galloway warned that the cabinet members' selfish purposes had overborne their patriotism, and tried to persuade Lincoln to drop Chase, whom he considered too radical on the slavery question. Even within the cabinet itself, Montgomery Blair, after consulting with Seward, went to the president with a report that the nation was going to ruin for the want of a proper head to the War Department, and begged him to oust Stanton. But after early November, most of the demands for cabinet changes came from the radical anti-slavery wing of Lincoln's party. In calling for a reorganization of the cabinet, radicals often hoped to oust Smith, who was nothing but a doughface, and Bates, who was a fossil of the Silurian era. But the chief focus of their attention was Seward, who'd come to represent everything that was wrong with the Lincoln administration. The Secretary of State, they alleged, had never had his heart in the war. He'd tried to negotiate with the Confederate envoys during the secession crisis. He'd opposed making a stand at Fort Sumter, he'd been McClellan's principal defender. He'd opposed and then delayed the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation. He and Thurlow Weed had undermined the candidacy of radical General Wadsworth for governor of New York. The publication, in December, of Seward's diplomatic dispatches to Charles Francis Adams, the American minister in London, gave further evidence that the secretary failed to understand the meaning of the American conflict. As late as July 5th, Seward denounced both the extreme advocates of African slavery and its most vehement opponents, the abolitionists, as being equally responsible for the Civil War. Seward must be got out of the cabinet, Joseph Medill of the Chicago Tribune announced. He's Lincoln's evil genius. He's been president de facto and has kept a sponge saturated with chloroform to Uncle Abe's nose. Lincoln became aware of the full extent of the hostility to the Secretary of State on December 16th, 3 days after the Battle of Fredericksburg, when a messenger brought him a note from Seward. "I hereby resign the office of Secretary of State of the United States, and have the honor to request that this resignation may be immediately accepted." In identical language, Frederick W. Seward, his son, resigned as Assistant Secretary of State. With a face full of pain and surprise, the president turned to Senator Preston King of New York, who accompanied the messenger, and asked, "What does this mean?" King reported that because of the immense popular excitement over the defeat at Fredericksburg, there had been an extraordinary caucus of Republican senators that afternoon in order to ascertain whether any steps could be taken to quiet the public mind and to produce a better condition of affairs. The real purpose of the caucus became clear when Senator Wilkinson accused Seward of exercising a controlling influence upon the mind of the president, and predicted that, so long as he remained in the cabinet, nothing but defeat and disaster could be expected. Senator Grimes offered a resolution declaring a want of confidence in the Secretary of State and calling for his removal from office. The highly respected Jacob Collamer argued that the president had no cabinet in the true sense of the word, and sharp-spoken William Pitt Fessenden said that there was a backstairs influence which often controlled the apparent conclusions of the cabinet itself. He refused to name Seward, but declared that senators might draw their own conclusions. Taken by surprise, the friends of the Secretary of State were nevertheless able to prevent unanimous adoption of Grimes's resolution of censure. Frustrated, Seward's opponents pressed for adjournment until the next day, and, by a vote of 16-13, got their way. King hadn't stayed for the final vote, but went immediately to Seward's house, where he reported the proceedings to the secretary. "They may do as they please about me," Seward declared, "but they shall not put the president in a false position on my account." He wrote out a letter of resignation. That evening, the president called at Seward's house, but found the secretary resolute in his determination to resign. He wired his family, who had been planning to join him in the Capitol, not to come, and he and his son began packing up their books and papers in preparation for a return to his home in Auburn, New York. Keeping Seward's resignation secret during the next 2 days, the president anxiously awaited the outcome of the Republican caucus. For months, the radicals in this group had been in frequent contact with Secretary Chase, who fed them stories of Lincoln's failure to consult with his cabinet advisers. For instance, he told Zachariah Chandler that there was, at the present time, no cabinet except in name. Though the heads of departments met now and then, no reports are made, no regular discussions held, no ascertained conclusions reached. Chase was also the source of Fessenden's statement about Seward's backstairs influence at the White House. Believing Chase's rumors, the caucus agreed on a resolution calling for a change in and a partial reconstruction of the cabinet. The senators then voted unanimously, with only two Republican senators absent, and Senator King not voting, to name a committee to present their views to the president.
This ends Disc 22.